Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa Collins College of Business Energy Lecture Series continues this week with a look at the Iranian oil industry. Once the second largest exporter of petroleum in OPEC, today under sanctions from the EU and the US, even Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was forced to admit that exports had dropped by 40% and oil income by over 45%. And due to this drop, the Iranian rial, its currency, has lost 60% of its value against the U.S. dollar, causing a deep, deep depression in the Iranian economy. Despite this, the Iranian regime continues to redouble its efforts to produce highly enriched uranium, which it says is being developed for civilian energy use, though most of the rest of the world believes that it's being used to develop atomic weapons. Last September, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported that their inspectors were once again turned away from inspecting a military site where military atomic applications were suspected. My guest today is Pasha Madavi, currently a doctoral candidate in political science at UCLA. He'll be giving this lecture on Wednesday night. He formerly worked at Stanford's Program on Energy and Sustainable Development, specializing on the Iranian National Oil Company, as well as Central Asian and Middle Eastern oil markets in general. He's also been a consultant to several NGOs involved with energy. He'll be speaking on oil politics in the Islamic Republic of Iran this Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium. The lecture is free and open to the public. Pasha Madavi, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Rich.
You've been following the Iranian oil industry, and certainly you've been following the sanctions that have occurred to the Iranian regime. First of all, how serious is the boycott of oil and energy products from Iran? How serious has it been to the Iranian economy?
It's actually been very serious. Some reports are saying that since July, over the past 6 months, 8 months or so, oil shipments are down about 50%. And they're looking at an estimated loss per day of about $130 million in lost oil sales. So that is a huge, huge hit, and equates to roughly 10% of overall loss in economic output. So it is quite significant, especially the last few months.
And the embargoes, there's always going to be leakage, but how complete is the embargo at this particular time?
It's actually quite effective. You know, there is, of course, always leakage. And one of the biggest points that the embargo has really affected is the issue of shipping and shipping insurance. So this is a key point. It's very difficult to get oil out to market when you can't insure the vessels by which you're exporting the oil. So it has been quite effective in that. But, of course, there is leakage. There is, you know, the issue of oil export via pipeline that's much tougher to regulate.
And I would think Iran has a number of pipelines outside of its country?
Yes. I mean, pipelines that go to Turkey, through Turkey, as well as north of Iran, pipelines to Turkmenistan and, of course, the Caucasus.
And I understand there's a new pipeline through Pakistan at some point that's looking to occur.
Yeah, that's a very interesting one. It's the India-Pakistan-Iran pipeline that has been politically contentious for almost a decade. It really just, that is a planned pipeline mostly for the export of natural gas, but which has not quite taken off yet. So this is something I'll be talking about at the University of Tulsa, is the issue of gas exports, and really something that Iran has not been able to accomplish. This is even before the sanctions. So this is another point at which the Iranian industry is struggling.
Now, your particular emphasis is looking at national oil companies, and I would think with the embargo, this is putting tremendous stress on Iran's national oil company.
Definitely. One of the biggest problems is access to technology, and the National Iranian Oil Company has to deal with a number of maturing oil fields, offshore oil, with which it needs the technology for enhanced oil recovery. And because of the embargoes, it's just not happening.
Now, politically, Iran has been, well, a pariah nation in recent years, but it's always been on the outs with a lot of the industrialized world since the Iranian Revolution to one extent or another. How much interplay between the rest of the international oil market and the National Iranian Oil Company has there been since the revolution? Is it a matter of that technology has been lagging for years or just since sanctions?
Well, it has been lagging for years. The situation was slightly improving at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, and Iran had tried to, especially through the National Oil Company, engage in some foreign partnerships. But one of the other things the sanctions have done is scare away a lot of foreign investment. A lot of the projects that were planned in the offshore oil and gas fields have since disappeared, mainly because of pressure from the international community on these private firms.
Now, the 10% that we were talking about, the 10% drop in just the economic output of Iran, how's that affecting average citizens? Do we have a sense?
Yeah, we do have a sense. Really, the climate economically is quite poor. One of the other issues that we have to deal with, not with just the loss of economic output, but also the issue of currency exchange. One of the other effects of the sanctions has been to make it very difficult to get foreign exchange. And this has played, essentially wreaked havoc on Iran's currency markets and stock markets. And when you talk about the average citizen, really it's just making matters much worse. Prices are up and down, quite volatile. Wages are not stable. Unemployment is increasing. So economically, it has had quite a large impact. But putting this into perspective, it has been going through a number of economic crises ever since the period of the revolution, with the Iran-Iraq war, with the low oil prices in the early 90s. So it's nothing new, this issue of being sanctioned and having to deal with pressure from the international community. But I will say that the latest round has had a bigger impact and had a more direct impact on the lives of local citizens, particularly those owning private firms.
Now, we remember the national elections from a few years back where, you know, you had huge turnout in the streets and lots of unrest. I would imagine, given this set of circumstance, how much unrest in the regime is there?
Well, it's not something I can really speak to. You know, from the perspective of the oil markets and from the perspective of, say, the issue of rising prices, there has been some unrest, but nothing on a high order.
You know, when are the next national elections?
They're coming up in June.
So this makes all this negotiation over the nuclear talks that have been going on, this is all playing into national election talks, isn't it?
Well, it might be. You know, the issue is that Ahmadinejad will not be running again. He's succeeded. You know, it will be the end of his second term. So the current administration is not, the current presidential administration has not been paying too much attention because they won't be running again. At the same time, though, the broader leadership is definitely concerned about the state of the economy as the elections approach. But so far, unrest has been quite low.
My guest today is Pasha Mahdavi. He is a PhD candidate from the Department of Political Science at UCLA. Previously, he was a research fellow at the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford. He is also an independent consultant for Revenue Watch Institute in New York, and he specializes in the study of national oil companies. He'll be speaking at the University of Tulsa's Collins College of Business Energy Lecture Series Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the oil politics in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, going back to the title of your lecture, are the oil politics any different in an Islamic Republic as opposed to other countries in the Middle East? Is there any differences that we should note?
Yes, actually, one of the differences is the amount of deliberation that's going on. You know, stressing the word republic here, you have a lot of moving parts to the government, parliament, the president, the supreme leader, which makes it very difficult to reach consensus. One of the things I'll be talking about is the political attitude towards the future of natural gas, and you have three competing political camps about how to deal with natural gas. It's something you wouldn't see in the other Middle Eastern countries, particularly the Gulf countries, which have a more centralized political structure. But the problem of just a lot of debate has been hampering, especially the natural gas industry. So something you don't see, for instance, with neighboring Qatar, with which Iran shares a massive natural gas field.
And what are the issues surrounding natural gas? How to exploit it, how to use it, or how to export it?
Exactly. You know,
all those questions.
All those questions. You know, one camp is focused on not exporting gas and using gas for essentially domestic consumption only, and trying to push out oil consumption within the domestic economy, replace that with gas so that oil can be exported. Now, another camp is saying, well, you know, we should use natural gas as an export and create a lot of value, pushing for pipeline expansion, pushing for liquefied natural gas terminals. And then you have a set of engineers who really would like to see gas used for reinjection into aging oil fields. So there's a lot of disagreement on what to do with Iran's natural gas.
Now, you mentioned aging oil fields. This is one of those, you know, knowing exactly what's underneath the ground in Saudi Arabia, it's a big mystery. The same in Iran. How effective are the oil fields of Iran? And, you know, you're looking at all this new technology, and we're seeing this huge boom in drilling using vertical techniques and fracking here in the United States. Any sense that Iran would benefit from those techniques? Are they suffering from outdated technology, or are the fields themselves a matter of concern to the leadership?
Well, it's a combination of both. The issue of technology is one that's seriously taken right now within Iran and the oil company itself, especially about the problem of reservoir pressure. And this is a problem that, of course, people have been dealing with in Oklahoma and Texas for some time now, and using state-of-the-art technology to extract as much oil as possible from a reserve. The Iranians have had this problem for the last 15 years with some of their major fields onshore. But on the other hand, there have been some exploration efforts and finding some potentially very lucrative offshore fields. The problem is, again, accessing those fields. And currently, the technology is not accessible for the Iranian oil company. So it's a combination of old fields that it's been problematic to get as much oil out of as possible, as well as trying to exploit some of the newer resources that, as of yet, remain unexploited.
Of course, the big issue confronting Iran at this point is the sanctions and its decision to pursue the enrichment of uranium. They maintain for peaceful peaceful civilian use, but the West is worried about the development of a Iranian nuclear weapon. And, you know, we hear a lot about the enrichment of uranium here in the West, but we occasionally will hear the Iranian side of the argument, which is that because of these aging oil fields and the fact that it plays such a large role on their economy, they want to use, according to the leadership, they want to use nuclear power to wean them from dependence on internal use of fossil energy and use every bit of that for export to bring in hard currency. Let me ask you, you've been following the Iranian national energy situation for a long time. Is there any truth to that argument?
Well, you know, yes and no, but I will say this is a bit outside my area of expertise. You know, the one thing I can say is that the consumption problem is quite serious. The demand forecasts are very scary for the Iranians in terms of energy consumption. You have a growing population, one that is, to a certain extent, still getting richer and getting electrified. The issue of generating enough electricity as well as providing enough fuel to feed this demand is quite problematic. And any way to replace burning oil and natural gas is certainly an option that the regime would like to take. Natural gas is still the dominant fuel for domestic consumption, gas-fired power plants. But there still is a big chunk of 30% or so of oil consumption domestically that they would like to free up for export. So calls, you know, right now for anything to displace that. And you know, that's where I see the nuclear power fitting in. But, you know, on the other hand, really the answer may not just be about electricity. There's only so much you can do by creating a nuclear power plant or more renewable capacity, for example, or hydroelectric. The transportation sector is still one of the bigger problems. Half of consumption of energy is still transportation. So that is an issue they have to address. And that's somewhere where the nuclear story doesn't quite fit in. Trying to wean the population off of using so much oil and natural gas for transportation.
I would think also that oil and gas is heavily subsidized internally.
Yes, that's the other thing I was just going to point to, is the issue of subsidies. Now, the regime has tried recently with a new legislation in 2010, 2011, the Targeted Energy Subsidies Act, to reduce energy subsidies and replace them with cash transfers. So far, that has been somewhat effective, but on the other hand, a lot of petroleum products and electricity still remain subsidized. So that is definitely connected with these demand forecasts that energy is very cheap. up until 2010, it used to be 10 cents per liter, or about 36 cents per gallon for gasoline. And, you know, when you have that, people have no incentive to conserve. It's quite crazy to think about, you know, $5 here and 36 cents a gallon. So subsidies is at the top of the agenda for the political camps in Iran to try to reduce demand.
My guest today is Pasha Mahdavi. He is a Ph.D. candidate at the UCLA Department of Political Science. He's worked at the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University, and he's been a consultant to a number of non-governmental organizations involved with oil. He will be giving a University of Tulsa Collins College of Business Energy Lecture Series on the oil politics in Iran. That takes place Wednesday of this week at 7 o'clock in Terrell Hall Auditorium, and the lecture is free and open to the public. Well, as we're speaking today, we've had one round of talks about the nuclear situation in Iran between major powers and the Iranian leadership, and the first round seemed to go well. Everybody was talking very optimistic, and then the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, basically threw a lot of cold water on what a lot of people thought some things were accomplished. I want to get back to what you were talking about before as far as how Iran deals in oil politics, because you have a legislative, you have the ruling president, then you have this theocracy that's also a part of it, and they have to all come to consensus to do anything. Is that pretty much the sense?
Exactly. Yes, it's very difficult to reach consensus.
And in fact, if you have the legislative and the executive together, the theocratic side can still really gum up the works and keep things from happening.
Yeah, definitely. And the lines are quite blurred. You know, coming from the perspective of the oil company itself, and speaking with oil company officials in the past, this is a big problem for them. They're getting different directions from different parts of the government. This is definitely a concern when it comes to big projects or foreign investment or partnerships, especially for some of the offshore resources. And it's just quite difficult. You know, you hear one thing from one part of the government, and then you hear another the next day from a different part of government. So it's quite challenging.
In the case of the Supreme Leader, he's, I think, late 70s, close to 80 at this point. Is there any sort of situation that, you know, at some point there'll be a changeover in how the theocratic side of the government will view the rest of the world?
Well, you know, it's not something I'm too well versed on to talk about, but at the same time, there's a lot of institutional mechanisms in place to handle the change. It really came about after Khomeini passed away in the late 1980s, and essentially now there's been a lot of institutional kind of contingency to what would happen if there's a change in leadership. So it is built in, and there are assemblies that will elect the next Supreme Leader should something happen.
I'm going to ask you one more Iranian internal politics question.
Sure.
You know, given the June elections coming up, are we likely to see a leader as polarizing as Ahmadinejad leading the Iranian? I mean, can you give us a sense of what the candidates that are vying for the presidency, are they very different from him, or are some of them pretty much out of his mold?
Well, it's actually a bit too early to tell, believe it or not. The Iranian political system is a bit different than ours, and campaigning starts much later than what we have here in the United States. So it is still too early to tell in terms of who might be the next leader. The current sense is that it will be someone quite different from Ahmadinejad, either someone from outside his camp or someone who has been, studies showing that, well, the Speaker of the Parliament might be running, or possibly the former mayor, another former mayor of Tehran. Of course, Ahmadinejad used to be the mayor of Tehran. But it's still too early to tell, despite it being March and the elections coming up in June.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes.
We can only hope for a system like that. Or the presidential election takes 3 months instead of 3 years. Well, my guest today is Pasha Mahdavi. He's going to be speaking on oil politics in Iran as a part of the University of Tulsa Collins College of Business Energy Lecture Series, which will take place Wednesday night at 7 o'clock in Terrell Hall Auditorium. The lecture is free and open to the public. If the West is able to come to some accommodation to Iran, What are the prospects for the oil industry if perhaps sanctions are lessened? And likewise, if sanctions are tightened, what's the prospects for oil production in Iran?
Yeah, it's quite a dramatic swing. You know, projections that I've seen are saying that in an optimistic scenario, production can go up to close to 6 million barrels per day. Right now, it's about 4 million barrels per day. So if the sanctions are lessened or even removed, they can increase their output capacity by 50%. On the other hand, a very pessimistic scenario, if sanctions are tightened or added new sanctions, you could see a drop to about 1.5 million barrels per day, which is a huge change and could change Iran from being a net exporter into a net importer of oil. So it's quite a big swing if you look at kind of the projections on what will happen to the oil industry given today's sanctions.
Given the fact that sanctions were put in place to bring Iran to the negotiating table to talk about their nuclear energy program, how effective have they been in your view?
Well, it's tough to tell. Again, from the oil industry perspective, they have been effective in reducing investment. Many within the oil industry have been dealing with a lot of new challenges in getting not just investment, but new technology, as we talked about before. So it's been very effective economically, and the question is, does that translate politically? And so far, negotiations remain stalled.
And this is one of where the great disconnect between the West, when you have economic prospects in the West failing, political will really follows very closely. And Iran seems to be immune to that to a certain extent.
To a certain extent, that's true. So far, like I mentioned, there have been a number of economic crises in Iran since the revolution. Following the Iran-Iraq war, again, the price collapse in the 90s, and of course, what's going on today. But you see the relationship with the political will, and there are ties, but it's certainly not as strong as what we see here in the West.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's going to be probably a very eventful spring in Tehran and throughout Iran as the presidential elections continue and the nuclear talks continue as well. Let's hope that continues on a hopeful note, given last week's round. Pasha Madavi, thanks very much for joining us.
All right, thanks very much for having me, Rich.
Pasha Madavi speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa Collins College of Business Energy Lecture Series lecture this Wednesday night at 7 o'clock in Terrell Hall Auditorium on oil politics in the Islamic Republic of Iran. The lecture is free and open to the public. Information at 918-631-2082. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
Jerry Eisenberg comes bounding down the ramp into the coffee shop at the Station Casino in Henderson, Nevada. Barry, he asks, I am about to have lunch with this best sports writer you've never heard of. We sit. He wants a booth. Old Jews want booths. Old Jews like coffee shops. My father is also an old Jew. More about this in a minute. Jerry doesn't need a menu. Look, he tells the waitress, I want ham and cheese on that bread. You know, that bread. What is that bread you have? The bread. And bring me a bowl of soup. He looks at me. I'm not ready to order. I order. I grew up reading Jerry Eisenberg in the 1970s. He wrote about sports, football, baseball, but boxing was his specialty. Ali specifically. Eisenberg appeared on a show called Sports Extra. It was a precursor to SportsCenter. His prose was poetry. He wrote about sports from the adult table. He talked about Ali winning in Zaire against Foreman and then taking a walk along the river in Kinshasa after the fight. The most famous and loneliest man in the world, he described him. Now Ali is wherever Parkinson's victims go. Jerry has lost a friend. He wouldn't know who the hell I am. I contacted Jerry a few months back after some story I had written for an online magazine about the New Jersey Star-Ledger, his paper for half a century. "You were the greatest sports writer I ever read," I emailed him. He wrote back, "What do you mean was? I'm old. I'm not dead." Charles Pierce of Esquire said, "When I was a baby sports writer, Jerry was one of the old guys around whom I would, in a relative sense, shut up and listen." I will do that today. The meal comes. Jerry's not happy. Old Jews in coffee shops never are. "You know," he says to me, "in this country, many people eat French fries with ketchup." The waitress returns. "This place," he tells her, and now he's smiling, "is 1,000 times better than when the old owners had it." He's flirting with her. She brings the ketchup. "Here," I say, "I brought you two of my books. You're under no obligation to read past the inscription page." "No, no, I'd like to," he says. "Give me your address, and I'll send you mine." I do. The waitress comes by again. I ask if she'll take a picture of us. I am, God help me, going to post the picture on Facebook. I climb into Jerry's side of the booth. God help me, again. Jerry smiles. I smile. The picture is taken. He tells me about a book he's writing on the Negro League, another one of former NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle, and how he just bought a house with a big window so he could see the mountains. In Jersey, he didn't see mountains. I'm sitting across from a man who has seen the last 60 years of America but somehow missed the mountains. He has covered every Super Bowl, every one of them. He had his wrist broken by a cop at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. He's still angry at Eugene McCarthy for not showing up. "Hey, Gene, where the hell are you? These kids are getting their heads bashed in," he tells me the story. He picks up the check. "The greatest sports writer you've never heard of is buying me lunch." But then he drops it. Literally, the check falls out of his hand. I am now under the table, literally at his feet. The symbolism is ridiculous. I pick it up. It drops. Again, again, I'm under the table. One more time, it drops. "Jerry, this is getting embarrassing." He tells me a joke about a Jewish grandmother who calls her grandson and says, "Come visit me, and when you get here, ring the doorbell with your elbow." "Why my elbow, Grandma?" "What?" she asks. "You're coming empty-handed?" Old Jews like jokes about older Jews. We get up to leave. Yes, the check drops again. At the register, we see my father coming into the coffee shop. "Told you. My dad is 86. Jerry is 82. Jerry's happy there's a Jew in Las Vegas older than he is. My father's just happy there's another Jew." My father sits down at the counter as I walk Jerry out. "I have to get an envelope for your books," he tells me. "Why? Are you sending them back to me?" "No, no," he laughs. "He's going to go gamble, and he needs something to hold them in." "Was wonderful meeting you," I say. "Yeah, nice." And with my books in a FedEx envelope, he heads to the sports book. He has the gait of a man half his age. When I get home, there's a package, two books inside, one about the New York Giants, one his autobiography. Through my eyes, with the inscription, "Remember, Barry, a friend in need is a pain in the ass." Jerry.
Barry Friedman is a writer, essayist, a columnist for Tulsa People magazine, a stand-up comic, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search our archives for the show you're looking for. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.